International.
Ici Radio-Canada. This is Canada.
This is Radio Nederland, the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland.
You're tuned to Swiss Radio International in Bern.
This is Free China as a presentation of the Voice of Free China, the international service of the Broadcasting Corporation of China.
This is Radio Havana, Cuba.
Broadcasting from Cuba, free territory in the Americas.
This is Radio South Africa.
This is Yugoslavia Radio Belgrade calling.
This is Israel broadcasting from Jerusalem.
This is Radio Pyongyang of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
This is the General Overseas Service of the BBC.
Hello, I'm Keith Perron, and welcome to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. We have actually a few things, a bit of a smorgasbord to get to on today's program. So to kick off right away, here's something from the archives, and then I'll explain to you why we're playing it.
This is Radio Sweden.
Sveriges Radio utlandsprogrammet.
This is Radio Sweden, Stockholm. Starting off with a bulletin of news, followed by our weekday current affairs magazine, Panorama, in which we look at the scene here in Sweden. And then lastly, some more music from Sweden. Here first then is the news.
Sveriges Radio Utlandsprogrammet.
Radio Sweden International.
Ni lyssnar till Sveriges Radio Utlandsprogrammet. Här kommer nu ett halvtimmesprogram på svenska.
Welcome to Radio Sweden at the weekend, today with a shorter than normal review of the top stories in Sweden of the week gone by, because this weekend we also mark the end of Radio Sweden's shortwave broadcasts. Coming up in our weekly review, the three red-green opposition parties announced...
Well, that was a selection of clips of Radio Sweden through the years, from their early beginnings right into their final on-air broadcast. Now, Radio Sweden may have left shortwave, but the station still exists today as an online service and FM service in Stockholm and other cities in Sweden. Now, with the big cut that they had to shortwave, this, of course, reduced the station's output. And people thought that, well, it would be okay for a while. Well, this is not the case. It was just announced this week that Radio Sweden, which currently offers news and current affairs programs in English, Arabic, Somali, Persian, Kurdish, German, Russian, and Romani, will be dropping two language services. The services that they're dropping this spring are Russian and German. The head of Radio Sweden, Ingmar Grofgren, said German and Russian are a reminder of the old overseas service of Radio Sweden, which no longer fits into our task to reflect the whole diversity in Sweden. The remaining language services of English, Arabic, Somali, Persian, and Kurdish will be moved under the Radio Sweden News. That's right, the main news department at the Swedish Broadcasting Corporation. So what other changes are going to be taking place at Radio Sweden? Well, it's no secret that before their big cuts to shortwave a few years ago, and since that time, they really haven't been hiring a lot of new staff. When people retire, basically that job is not replaced. And if it is replaced, it's replaced with a freelancer. So we'll have to wait and see what else happens. Let's now move to an update to a story that we talked about last year. Canadian documentary filmmaker Amanda Dawn Christie was producing a film about the Sackville shortwave relay and the taking down of the big towers. Well, it's come closer to being a reality.
This is Radio Canada International.
This is Radio Canada International, broadcasting to Europe, to Africa, and to the Middle East on 5850-5995, 11690, 11965, 12015, 12035, 15325, and 17870 kilohertz. Coming up, Canada Today, a daily news magazine from Radio Canada International.
Well, Amanda Dawn Christie's documentary, Spectres of Shortwaves, will be finished in time for the possible premiere at the Toronto Hot Docs. That's D-O-C-S, not hot dogs. This is an annual documentary film festival that takes place in the Canadian city of Toronto. She recently spoke to CBC Radio, and she said that on average to produce a one-hour TV documentary in Canada, the cost is around $400,000. She said right now the budget that she's working with is less than $100,000. She says she's hoping to have the film accepted to be shown at the International Documentary Film Festival, which will mean all of us who were regular listeners of Radio Canada International and have fond memories of broadcasters like Ian McFarland and others will have something to look forward to. This is what she had to say on the program when I spoke to her a few months ago.
Well, it first started as a choice about, as a station more, as an architectural element in the landscape was initially what inspired me. I was living in Sackville, and so that site was just continually a part of the landscape for basically as long as I'd lived there. And in the region, a lot of locals would be like a landmark. When you were driving somewhere, that would let you know how far along the way you were. And that landscape, it's very flat. It's a saltwater marsh that's actually below sea level. The ocean's held back just by dikes. And then here are these 430-foot towers, just like the masts of a ship sticking up. So it initially started as just as an aesthetic interest in the role of those towers in the landscape. And then the more I started doing my research, the more it became about the role of that site for international communications. And then when I started filming, that was when they announced that they were going to tear it down. And so, of course, the project evolved to include the demolition of it as a historical document.
Many years ago, probably around 25 years ago, I visited Sackville. And I remember speaking to somebody locally about Sackville, and I said to them, what is it like having this huge site, you know, not far from where you live? And they said to me, and I'll always remember this, they said it's an interesting feeling, because they said it's hard to think that little Sackville is broadcasting to listeners behind the Iron Curtain.
Yes, it's an amazing feeling being there, because Sackville is a small town. You're talking between 3,000 and 6,000 people, depending on when there's a university there. So if the students are there, the population practically doubles. And to know that this site is broadcasting to Europe, Africa, South America from this tiny little town was quite amazing. And there are people in that population who, many people didn't even know what the towers did. They were just a part of the landscape. And then the other people who did know what they did, there was just that extra layer of appreciation. And many people, as I was filming, described the tower. You would think a big, high-power, high-voltage site would be ominous. And yet, everyone, there was a sort of a comfort that people seemed to take in them. Everyone spoke of the towers fondly, about how it was like a sense of letting you know you were home. At night, the towers had these red lights, obviously, for aircraft that would light up. And everyone I interviewed would just talk about the red lights and how when they were driving on the highway, they just knew they were home. And during the demolition phase, any time when I wasn't shooting, if I was in one of the cafes or the local pub, there was a deep sadness in the town. Just that it was a very interesting and strange relationship that the town had with those towers.
Spectres of Shortwave by Canadian documentary filmmaker Amanda Dawn Christie will be shown at the Hot Docs Festival in Toronto, Canada. The sound that we heard after her little voice there, little voice clip, I should say, was actually the sound of one of the towers. She had attached these special microphones to the towers before they were taken down, and that was the eerie, spooky sound that came from it. We're going to have a short break here on Media Network Plus. When we come back, Richard Ady is going to be joining us to tell us about the first privately launched newspaper in the Kingdom of Bhutan. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file.
Category 105, which is PDF to total journal.
Speed 220, Category 105.
The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
Bundy Avison used to be in women's magazines. She was the editor of Woman's Day and the editorial director of New Idea. But in the early noughties, while in Bhutan with her husband, the country was changing, moving toward democracy. And Bundy found that her expertise was needed on the country's first independent newspaper, the Bhutan Observer.
The time that they decided to launch newspapers was around the same time that newspapers were being so challenged everywhere else in the world. So it was a big call for a couple of reasons, and it's had mixed success.
Well, that's it. You said there was one newspaper run by the government. Nobody read it. So there's no culture of reading newspapers.
No, there's no culture of reading. It's an oral culture.
No culture of reading at all.
No culture of reading at all. That's changing slowly, but culturally, no. It's an oral culture where they had, there's something like 23 different languages, not dialects, but languages, and all of them are oral with no written form. And then the king decided about 30 years ago that they needed to be able to create a written form for one of these languages as part of this moving into the modern world. So while there was, the monasteries had prayer books and they had writing and reading, the mainstream people didn't write things down and they didn't read.
So in fact, isn't there a saying that if you want to keep a secret in Bhutan, write it in a book?
That's right, because no one will read it.
Okay, I can see what possessed you then.
It was a challenge, unlike any other.
Well, let's get a sense of the paper itself, so the office and the staff. Given that there's no real tradition of reading newspapers, how much training did the people who were actually putting the paper out have?
Well, they didn't have any training. Well, it varied. Some of them had gone to India and had worked on newspapers there or been trained. The newspaper that existed, the government one, had evolved over time. And the story of the government newspaper was quite an interesting one. The man who launched it, Kinley Dorji, came to Australia to learn to be a journalist. And he was the country's first journalist. And that was about 25, 30 years ago, and he was in the same year as Andrew Denton and Amanda Keller at Bathurst. And he was sent by the king at the time to go and learn to be a journalist, come back and start or move our government gazette towards being a newspaper. So that government gazette, Kunsul newspaper, was started by the country's first journalist that was trained in Australia. And then he trained people under him that worked on that newspaper. So there was, when I say that there was no tradition of newspapers, not amongst the mainstream, certainly the educated government people and the royal family read the newspaper, but the majority of people didn't. And so when the family that I knew decided they wanted to start a newspaper, there weren't any journalists to kind of, you know, poach or to, and they couldn't bring people in from outside.
How did they recruit?
Well, the recruiting was a lot of fun. They invited university graduates to come and explain what they would do on the newspaper. And the ones that wrote an essay in English that made the most sense about what a newspaper could be got the job. The sense of enthusiasm and this is a brave new world was brilliant.
And I suppose the other thing is that you don't know what you can't do. You're not restricted by the kind of the norms of doing a newspaper or the orthodoxies of how you do journalism.
That's right. Absolutely.
And that can be positive.
And they came up with such creative ways to do things. For example, there was no businesses to go and say buy space to sell your product. They just didn't have that kind of marketing advertising culture. So what they did is they went to Wikipedia and downloaded a list of days. You know, like there's International Tuberculosis Day, International Hand Washing Day, International Talk Like a Pirate Day.
Yes.
They downloaded that list, highlighted all the ones that they thought were relevant, and then went to various NGOs and government departments to get them to sponsor information pullouts that week. So it wasn't advertising as we would recognise it. It was more public service pullouts that matched these international days.
All right. So how did it fit into this newly evolving media landscape? Because you've already mentioned there was the government paper. And I think there was another independent starting around the same time.
Yes, two of them launched at the same time, Bhutan Times and Bhutan Observer. Well, they were greeted with a lot of enthusiasm, and it appeared to a lot of the educated class that this was a good thing to do to launch newspapers. There are currently, or last time I looked, there was a dozen newspapers. All of them are failing. There still isn't advertising. There still isn't much of a newspaper culture.
What is in them? If I pick up one of these papers, if I pick up the paper you worked at, what am I going to read about, assuming I can read that language?
You'll read very much what's going on with the Bhutanese government, with what's happening in the main city of Thimphu. It's very local news, and it's things about the roads, what the farmers are doing, the price of potatoes. Very domestic news.
It's a very agricultural country, isn't it?
So yes.
You're going to, I imagine, there's going to be a lot about agriculture.
Yes. And there's also a lot about the royal family.
I guess the royal family's at the top of the hierarchy. Is there a tradition in which you can ask hard questions of people who are kind of not at your level?
It's a very hierarchical structure socially. So that has been a challenge for them with this new media landscape, or now having journalists asking questions, because traditionally you wouldn't. Traditionally you wouldn't ask questions of a very important person or somebody who was part of the senior government or certainly the royals. You just wouldn't question them. But that's being turned on its head now that they are a democracy and now that there is an active media.
And so how do the people who are not used to being asked questions, who've spent perhaps decades not being asked questions, when somebody rolls up and asks them a question?
It's been very challenging. So some of the government ministers have refused to respond. They're in a state of everybody's learning their roles. So the journalists are learning to ask the hard questions and the ministers are learning to be accountable. And it's a bit of a dance and it's a bit of learning on both sides and in constant negotiation.
I can't ask about Bhutan without thinking of this gross national happiness, because that is probably the thing that Bhutan's best known for, isn't it?
Yes.
Is it real?
Yeah. Look, I spent a lot of time trying to get my head around gross national happiness. This is something that comes up in conversation pretty much every part of the day.
Really?
It is so much part of their public discussion about, yes.
So at news meetings, when you're trying to work out what you're covering, it's going to come up?
Yes, repeatedly. It is how they frame all of the what they consider to be progress within their country.
You tell a story, actually, in your book about a reporter who actually, trailing along these sorts of public meetings where everyone says how full of gross national happiness they are, he actually tests that and finds it's not that simple.
Yes, he went along because they once a year they will go right across the country and interview every single inhabitant to ask them about their level of happiness and how they're going.
And people say they're fantastically happy, don't they?
People are confronted with these important people from the capital, Thimphu. They're visiting them. They're so overwhelmed and impressed that these people have come, and they say yes to anything that they're asked. And this reporter from the Bhutan Observer saw this going on, and because he was also from a poor village, he could see exactly what was going on. So after these important men with their ledgers left, he asked the local farmers, "And are you happy?" And they said, "Well, of course not. We haven't got enough food to eat." And he was able to unpack, using his skills as a journalist and using his voice as a journalist and his platform, he was able to bring that to the fore in a way that their institutionalised structures weren't.
No, indeed. How did the story go down, though?
Beautifully. It's what they wanted. It's part of this kind of change and dynamism even the Gross National Happiness Commission themselves, who were conducting the survey, were happy that it came out. That's what they're trying to, you know, dismantle and discover.
You mentioned earlier that there's now something like 12 newspapers and they're all sort of struggling.
Yes.
What about, and also that the country is very, it's a spoken culture. Where does that leave social media, something like Facebook?
Yes. Well, this is what has been such an extraordinary change for them. So while newspapers arrived and were struggling, at the same time digital media arrived, mobile phones were phenomenally successful. There's something like 93% of households have a mobile phone.
Wow.
And they use them to do all sorts of things. They use them to stream radio. So you've got yak farmers in remote mountain areas who are completely up to date with what's happening in politics and streaming Parliament live on their mobile phones. They're a terribly politically engaged culture. But then they're also using Facebook. Facebook has been phenomenal. It's created this space where they now have all that public discussion that the King wanted to happen in the newspapers, but it just being an oral culture, the newspapers weren't so successful. Modern media, digital media, has created this space for all of that. So the Facebook pages are, they use them for political activism, for culture. They use it like a virtual town square. Facebook has been, somehow it has absolutely culturally been appropriate for them. They love it.
So this change that the King instigated, it's working. And what it's doing, though, is exposing problems of if you don't have enough to eat, there's a lot of poverty in a country like Bhutan. It's not the Shangri-La that it's too often easy to think of, a country which celebrates and, you know, gross national happiness. These changes, beginning with newspapers, but also with mobiles and social media, they're actually making a difference.
Yes. What I found so interesting going back there again and again is that before newspapers arrived, before television arrived, in particular television, there was a lot of talk in the West and concern that it would ruin Bhutan, all this outside influence. But actually what the Bhutanese are doing with all these modern media is they're using it to talk amongst themselves and they're using it to reflect their own culture to each other. And before mobile phones and things, if you're talking about remote farmers, they would see other farmers once a year at the annual Seshu, the festival. Now they have a media space where they find about history, about their leaders, about their culture. So it's created a really vibrant space where they're talking and they're animated and they're criticising and showcasing all things that are important to them.
Bunty Averson is the author of The Dragon's Voice, How Modern Media Found Bhutan.
Thanks a lot, Richard. All right, it's now time to go to our propagation and find out what's been happening and what we can expect. Here's Glenn Hauser.
Keith from IPS in Australia through January 22nd. The global HF propagation outlook, normal at low and mid latitudes, normal to fair at high latitudes. From Space Weather South Africa through January 23rd, magnetic conditions quiet to unsettled. Shortwave fade-outs unlikely. MUF unstable. From Met Office UK, isolated active geomagnetic periods, January 22nd and 23rd. from FK Jana in Prague, the geomagnetic field will be quieto-active on January 22nd, 28th, February 1st, 2nd, and 9th. Mostly quiet January 23rd, 24th, February 6th, and 7th. Quiet on January 25th, 29th to 31st, February 4th and 5th. Quiet to unsettled on January 26th, February 3rd and 10th. Active to disturbed on January 27th and February 8th. From SWPC in Boulder, geomagnetic field unsettled to active January 22nd, 23rd, 28th, 29th, February 2nd, 3rd, 7th, 8th and 9th. ANKNSC is peaking at 12 and 4 on the 22nd, 18 and 5 on the 28th, 15 and 4 on February 2nd, 12 and 4 on the 7th and 8th. Lowest indices of 5 and 2 on January 24th to 27th, 31st, February 1st, 5th, 6th, and 11th to 13th. Solar flux rising from 95 January 22nd to 110 February 1st to 4th. William Hepburn's VHF, UHF, DX propagation maps show extreme tropospheric ducting off the Pacific coast of Mexico all week. And January 24th to 26th between Madagascar and Mozambique.
Thanks, Glenn. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. The next couple editions of the show will not have propagation because we're going to be doing a little bit of traveling and we're going to be presenting the best of Media Network Plus. So until next time, friends, I'm Keith Parent wishing you well, saying 73 and 88 to the ladies.